MechCast, Monday, September 2nd, 2013. Hey, MechGeeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for MechGeeks by MechGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Well, I have to tell you, just when I think that we're never going to have anything to talk about when it comes to Apple and Mac-related stuff, lo and behold, I prepped the show, and like always, there is a ton of things for us to talk about. Going to have another great, fun, big show for you, loaded up with all kinds of stuff to talk about. Of course, we've got the latest on iPhone 5S and 5C rumors, a new color possibly coming into the mix. We'll talk about that a little bit. Apple's launching their own trade-in program, so you can get some cash for that old iPhone, maybe fund the purchase of that new one. A couple new updates to the Apple TV. Apple getting ready for an iWatch maybe sometime in 2014. And a whole host of other things that we need to get into. Also, your feedback and comments. I have an update on iOS in the car and some recommendations there. A little more on the podcast app conversation that we've been having. The fact of, is Apple's app really all it's cracked up to be? I personally think not, but some of you disagree, and we're going to hear from you on that. A little reminder on some of the things you should take into consideration when you're doing your backups, and I found a cool tip about upgrading some of your older iTunes movies, HD movies, to higher quality, and a little trick for doing that. So we're going to get into all that stuff and more here in a minute, but before we get started, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Transporter by Connected Data. You know, the Transporter is this awesome little device, a little hard drive that you can get network connected that allows you to do peer-to-peer storage, lets you share your files and data privately. So it works like private cloud storage. It's kind of like cloud storage in that you can share your stuff via the internet, but it is peer-to-peer, which means your data always is in your control. It's 100% private. There's no third-party server involved at all. All you use the web service for is simply setting up your transporter and adding people. But the actual communication, the actual sending files back and forth, doesn't happen through any kind of server. It's just device to device. And it's amazingly easy to set up. You get the transporter. You can order it with or without a drive. You can put your own 2.5-inch hard drive if you want. They also have 1 terabyte and 2 terabyte options, and you plug it in, you connect it to your network via Ethernet. You could also use Wi-Fi with a little USB adapter. You launch the software, you set it up, and you're pretty much good to go. You start adding people you want to share stuff with. You can set up folders and sharing things, and there are no annual fees. You just buy the transporter, and that is it. That's all you're going to need. You can share with other transporters. You can share with other Macs and PCs. Not everybody has to have a transporter, but it helps when you are sharing with the transporter. Makes the setup and process just that much simpler. And you can access your files remotely because the transporter doesn't need to be hooked up to a computer. It is an autonomous device. It sits on your network, so you can get back. You can access all your files directly from your iPhone, your iPad. They have an Android app, and all of the transfers are encrypted. You can even make backups hidden and encrypt your data on remote transporter devices, so you can use it as a backup system as well for your critical files, especially if you get a couple of transporters. Buy two of them. You can have one at the office, one at home, and back up your stuff that way. And with the new 2.0 software, they've made sharing your files and data from your transporter even easier. You can set up direct links that let users securely download files directly from your transporter, so you can just right-click, create a link, send that link to someone, and they'll be able to get files right off your transporter. They don't even have to set up an account, do anything like that. You can learn more by going to filetransporter.com/MacCast. And because you're a MacCast listener, you can get 10% off the purchase of your transporter from the company store. Just go to filetransporterstore.com. And when you're checking out, use the code MACCAST after selecting your transporter. Pricing starts at just $199 for the driveless version. And as I said, they have 1 terabyte and 2 terabyte options, so you can get it ready to go out of the box. Couldn't be simpler. And a big thank you to Connected Data and Transporter for their support of the MACCAST. We're now just about a week away from Apple's iPhone event that should be happening on September 10th. Invitations will be going out sometime soon, probably toward the end of this week, I would imagine, to the press and media. So we'll know officially from Apple. But it's pretty much given that we are going to have the iPhone event coming up. And my friend Clayton Morris says via his Twitter account that Apple's new iPhone 5S is going to be running about 31% faster than the current iPhone 5. That'd be the one running the A6. It's going to reportedly have a new A7 processor. The story over at 9to5Mac seemed to provide a lot of the details. According to them, they said that the A7 and the iPhone 5S will still be dual core, but it's going to gain the extra speed because it's going to be 64-bit. They say that multiple independent sources are telling them that Apple has been at least testing out 64-bit CPUs in the iPhone 5S. So it seems like it could happen. The claim is that the extra juice would be used to smooth out animations and the transparency and some of the other graphics effects that are going to be in iOS 7's new user interface. Now, I've been looking at the videos online. I've been hearing reports, reading things, and I've not seen or had anyone mention that the animations or any of the sort of graphics eye candy that's in iOS 7 is causing any kind of issues, even for the current hardware, so I'm not sure that that's necessarily why they would be beefing up the processor. I think they just want to stay in line and be competing with some of the other Android devices that are coming out there, and you just want to crank things up, especially if you can do it without any cost to battery life. Now, so we know from the 9to5 report that they are saying Apple is testing 64-bit processors. The question is, will we actually see the 5S become the first 64-bit iPhone? And maybe not. Clayton didn't say specifically that the processor was 64-bit, just that it was running about 31% faster. Ming-Chi Kuo does think that 64-bit mobile processors will happen, but might not be happening this year. Apple could be just doing some early prototype testing with the 5S with a 64-bit processor, and we could see that in the next update of Apple's CPU, maybe the A8s, sometime next year. Clayton Morris also did hint on Twitter that we would be seeing some camera updates as well. Specifically, he mentioned a dedicated motion tracking chip. I'm not sure entirely what that would be used for. I know there's some new accessibility features in iOS 7 that actually allows it to track your head movements so that you can use head movements to actually control your device. That would be pretty interesting. It also makes you think of Microsoft Xbox Kinect kind of games that might be capable if you have that motion tracking in the iPhone camera, although it would seem a bit odd to kind of set up your iPhone with its little tiny screen and then be doing that kind of thing for games. So I don't know specifically what it would be used for. I would imagine also that the EyeSight camera may not get a spec bump. Some people are thinking it might bump up to 12 megapixel from the 8 megapixel, but even if it stays at 8 megapixel, I fully expect that the image signal processing chip will see some improvements, and that would come in the form of maybe better low light capabilities, better processing. We've already heard some of those rumors. We've also heard rumors that it would support 120 frames per second slow motion video capture in the new camera. Now, as far as other specs, we haven't heard too many rumors on the RAM that might be coming with the iPhone 5S update, unless I've missed them. The current iPhone 5 has 1 gigabyte of RAM, so it would be nice if Apple bumped that up to maybe 2 gigabytes in the 5S. I would expect that might happen. Again, if there's some sort of benefit to the overall system, I'm not sure that more RAM inherently means a better phone, but if they can get more RAM in there, I think it would be good. There's been a long-standing rumor, of course, that the iPhone 5S will feature a fingerprint scanner built into the home button. Current thinking is that it is going to be for unlock only at first, so just a quick way to unlock your device, but Apple supposedly eventually wants to use that fingerprint technology for some sort of payment system in the future, but according to rumors, it's not going to be there at launch. And I still think we've got this debate about, is Apple going to do NFC or are they going to build some sort of payment system? I'm still looking to their technology, the stuff that they use in the Apple stores, the Easy Pay, where you just scan a barcode with your phone and then it ties into your iTunes account. I think that is Apple's killer payment system. And if they can roll that out, get other retailers on board and signed up to use that same system, I would love it to be the day where Apple just has my credit card information tied to my iTunes account and I can use that to pay for stuff all over the place. I think a lot of iPhone owners and people who use Apple devices would really appreciate that. Now, I'm having Clayton on the next MacCast. We're going to be chatting a little bit, so I'm going to try and get his updates on this information as well as some more things that he's been talking about recently on the next show, so stay tuned for that. As for when we'll be able to get our hands on the next iPhones, I already mentioned that Apple is expected to unveil the devices at the September 10th event, but we haven't received an official launch date when Apple will start shipping the phones, although this week it came out that Apple is stopping its support staff from going on vacation between September 15th and September 28th. And generally when they do that, that means they are having some sort of launch. I think September 15th would be a little bit too early. We've heard similar vacation blackouts for around the same period happening at a number of Apple's carrier partners also. So pretty good indication it's going to be sometime in that time frame. Most of the rumors seem to be pointing to a Friday, September 20th release date. That would make sense because Apple typically launches the phones on a Friday, or at least they have in the past. Apple Insider has also reported that a leaked Nuance Technology email sent to developers seemed to indicate that iOS 7 might show up in advance of the release of the new iPhones, maybe as early as September 10th. Now, it would be a little bit unusual for Apple to release the OS that early. Typically, they will release an OS a few days before the actual launch of the device. So if they do start selling iPhones on September 20th, I would expect it maybe just a few days in advance of that. They usually want to give developers a few days after the announcement of the phone and the release date for it and the release date for iOS to sort of finalize their applications, get them submitted into the App Store and all that sort of thing. They typically won't announce the new OS on the same day and that they actually release it. So September 10th, I think, would be a little bit early. But stay tuned for all of that. We should know here in a couple weeks. One thing that seems to be true is that this new iPhone event or the launch for the new iPhones will bring a lot more color to Apple's lineup, not just with the new low-cost colored iPhones, but also on the upper end with some new colors, or at least a new color as far as we knew, in the iPhone 5S lineup at the high end. So we had the rumors that gold was the new white. Now this week, a new update, we're hearing that graphite may be the new black. We've long been hearing the rumor that the iPhone 5S launch will be adding the new champagne and white colored iPhone choice. That's the long rumored gold iPhone. It's going to be more of a muted kind of color. Don't think bright gold, but this sort of just light champagne style gold. And that was supposed to be introduced alongside the traditional white and aluminum and the black and slate color options that we had. So we were going to have three. Now it seems like there might be this fourth option that surfaced this week, and it would be this sort of gray or graphite and black combination. Mac Rumors had the images of the new color choice. They were posted by Sunny Dixon, an Australian blogger and iOS developer who I guess has turned into a leak source for Apple photos, especially around the new iPhone. He's got high quality images. He's posting tons of these images, reportedly of the new iPhone 5C and 5S cases. And this past week, he had this new gray, sort of slate graphite one. Mend My Eye has also posted some comparison photos showing volume and power buttons and mute switches for all the different color iPhones. They had the champagne one, the black and slate, or the slate one, as well as the silver buttons, but they also too had this new sort of graphite color. So we're seeing it from a couple different sources, and actually looking at it, I kind of like it. It's sort of this lighter gray, more contrasty to the black. It really emphasizes this sort of two-tone effect and sort of gives a little nostalgia back to, I think, the iPhone in a way, harkening back almost in my mind to the original iPhone where you had that sort of black plastic part on the back and then the silver contrasting with that. An iMore piece throws out an interesting theory that the gray and graphite might actually replace the black model, since the black and slate one has proven to be pretty scratch prone and reportedly is hard for Apple to actually anodize that color with any kind of consistency. So will it replace? Is it an additional color? Are we going to have four color choices, three color choices? What is Apple going to do? I'm going to put my money on this is a late edition sort of fourth color, and Apple could have four colors. It's hard for me to make that call, though, because I think Apple traditionally, when they start doing multiple colors, certain colors become more popular than others, and then you sort of have this kind of stocking issue where you have to kind of figure out how many of each color to make, and it's a lot more on the inventory side. I think Apple likes traditionally to have things very simple, and having just two colors or one color choice would seem the easier way to go, but the new Apple seems to like different colors and choices, and maybe that's what consumers are demanding. I don't know. How do you feel about it? I was kind of okay with just picking black or white, but certainly on the iPhone 5C side, we've been seeing all of these different colors. It's expected to come in five colors: white, green, blue, yellow, and red. Although I have to tell you, from a lot of the images I've seen, the yellow sometimes looks a little bit more on the orangish side. And the red definitely comes across more as a salmon kind of pink color. I am not a big fan of the iPhone 5C colors. They seem to be these trendy colors, this almost sort of neon-ish, muted neon colors, which are coming into vogue. I've seen it around in clothing styles and things like that over the past few months or something like that. So maybe these are the colors for the season, but personally, not my favorite colors. I don't know what you think. But I also am leery, as I've said in past shows, to sort of judge the colors just based on the photos that you see, because very often colors are shifted. So I think I actually need to see them in person before I pass judgment. But certainly going to be a colorful event coming up here in the following weeks. And when we do get those iPhone announcements, do you think Apple will also throw a little and one more thing, iPad announcement in there as well? iMore is saying that Bloomberg ran an article suggesting that Apple might actually use the September 10th event to also announce the new iPads. To date, many have really believed, myself included, that Apple plans to unveil the new iPhones on the 10th and then would follow up with another event, possibly near the end of the month or maybe even in early October, to announce the iPads, that we'd actually have two separate events. I think we could maybe see some new iPods sprinkled in at the iPhone announcement, or they might just update the iPods sort of on the sly in the background, just update through the website and not really announce anything huge. Also, at some point, I think we should also expect them to talk about and announce officially the release date for the new Mac Pro. We've also been hearing that Apple is planning Haswell-based MacBook Pros. There's speculation on that. We don't know when they're going to make that announcement. So Apple has a lot of stuff to tell us about. As far as how they will fit all that in, my gut tells me that the Mac Pros and the MacBook Pros, as well as the iPads, are all going to happen in a separate event sometime in early October, and that at this September 10th event, Apple's going to keep it really focused on the iPhone, maybe new iPods, iTunes, as well as the updates to iOS 7, the official announcement on when Apple's going to start shipping that. I think that's going to be the primary focus, and that should be plenty to cover in one episode, but, you know, in one event. So what do you think? And I don't know about you, but because we've been talking about these rumors for so long, I've been sort of squirreling away, saving my pennies, looking at my budget, knowing that in the fall, this fall, I was going to have to drop some cash on a new iPhone, maybe some new iPads and things like that. But very often, a lot of us will also sell some of our older devices, try and trade those in, get rid of them, use different services, maybe get a little cash from a service like Gazelle to actually fund the purchase of our new device. Well, this week, it was rumored, I guess late last week actually, but later confirmed by CNBC, that Apple was going to and did on Friday announce their own trade-in program. Apple is reportedly working through a company called Brightstar, which is a services company specializing in the mobile market, to do a cash for iPhone trade-in program, or cash for old device trade-in program. Apple retail store employees will reportedly let you trade in your device. They will use a little app that's on their iPads in the store, their iPhones in the store, to get you a quote for your device right then and there. If you choose to accept it and take their offer, they will reportedly wipe your device right there in front of you, give you an Apple gift card for that trade-in program, and then you can use that gift card to make a new purchase, I would assume, of your new iPhone, but probably also almost anything in the store. Now, the trade-in program is supposedly part of Tim Cook's strategy of getting more customers to come into an Apple store to buy their phones directly from Apple. If you remember, a couple weeks back, we had the story that he wanted to get more people buying direct from Apple rather than going through the carrier partner stores or other resellers. And that's because Apple ultimately has to do the support and services for all those devices. So they'd like to get those sales to help offset some of those costs. So it seems like regardless of whether you buy your phone from a third-party carrier or whether you buy it directly from Apple, if you have a problem, you're going to be in there at the Genius Bar. You're not going to AT&T or Verizon to actually get your service. So how much could you actually get from Apple for your old device? Well, 9 to 5 Mac says they're hearing that around an average price of $250 to $253 for a 16-gigabyte iPhone 5 in good condition. If you have an older device, something like an 8-gigabyte iPhone 4, they're saying that could be worth between $120 to $140. For some reason, the CDMA versions of the iPhone don't seem to do as well. An 8-gigabyte CDMA iPhone 4, according to them, is worth around $80. And Apple does have information. I found a link on Apple's website to their recycling gift card program. You could actually go in there and plug in the information on their website and get an offer. Now, I don't know if this is the same thing as this new trade-in program or if that already existed. It was just what I discovered after I did some poking around after this announcement. And so I did a little bit of comparison because Gazelle came out and they sort of had a response this week. They announced that they would allow you to lock in a guaranteed trade-in offer price through their site until October 15th. So if you want to go on now, because these prices fluctuate, and as you get closer to a release date, the prices are going to go down pretty rapidly. So you can go there, you can actually lock in your offer, something I don't think you can do with Apple's program, and take advantage of that. Now, Gazelle is a sponsor of the MacCast. I am a fan of their service, so throw that out there right now. But I wanted to go ahead and price my device on Apple's site versus Gazelle's. And so I took a 32 gigabyte iPhone 4 that I have. I call it in fair condition because I have a few little scratches on the screen. And through Apple's system, I got an offer of $110 US. Through Gazelle's system, $130 US. So pretty comparable, but a little advantage to the Gazelle side. And you're going to have to decide what works for you. A lot of people, I think, are going to opt for the convenience of just right there in the Apple store doing the trade-in, ready to go. They can see it getting wiped. And so there's some advantages there. But this is a whole new market, and it's actually a new market for Apple, I guess I should say. And Gazelle, for their part, I think, came out with a statement, said they really welcome the competition. They said this sort of validates the program and the services that they've been offering for years, and having Apple in here as a player just raises awareness for the whole idea of re-commerce services in general. So it's good for everybody who's sort of playing in this market. And why is this of benefit to Apple? Well, they can take back these devices, get them back in their system or into their partner's system, refurbish them, and then turn around and sell them for some secondary market profit. So it's almost like they get to resell the devices again and make a little more profit off of that, especially in emerging markets. I think a lot of these things are going to go into their more price-sensitive markets as refurbished devices and be offered to customers who are maybe a little more price-sensitive. So in the long run, I think it's good all around, both for Apple and for some of the other third-party re-commerce services that are out there. I doubt you or I would find it surprising that as smartphones and tablets and post-PC devices become more and more popular, as more and more hit the streets, that they are becoming a ripe target for hackers and malware and all that bad stuff that we're used to having on our PCs. But the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the U.S. Department of Justice put out a cautionary memo this week with some of their findings on the latest mobile malware and where it is being targeted. The data is reportedly from 2012 and was published on the website Public Intelligence. They actually found that just 0.7% or under 1% of all mobile malware is designed to take advantage of exploits in iOS. By contrast, Android was shown to account for about 79% of all mobile malware threats at this point. The report notes that 44% of Android users are still running older, outdated versions of the operating system, specifically Gingerbread, and that might be part of the reason why you're seeing more out there. Android's more fragmented. The OS tends to be updated less frequently by its users from a lot of the data that we've seen. So that sort of environment kind of becomes a ripe target for hackers and malware. On the iOS side, it's been shown that iOS users tend to upgrade pretty rapidly after Apple puts out a new version, and a lot of times those new versions close up a lot of those holes and security issues. I'm not saying that's exactly what's happening in the study, but it makes sense when you sort of think about it. The study also did find that BlackBerry was still a pretty large target, a lot larger than iOS. 19% of the malware targeted BlackBerry devices. I would imagine BlackBerry is sort of a ripe target because it has so many ties to businesses, and a lot of business users use BlackBerry devices, and that would be the kinds of data that a lot of hackers would want to go after. Nokia's Symbian OS and Windows Phone were actually less of a target than Apple's devices. That's not surprising just based on the number of devices out in the marketplace. Both of those were found to be a target about 0.3% of the time. The important thing in all of this, I think, is to remember that even being a small target is still being a target. We do know that there's attacks and malware that have reportedly hit and targeted iOS, so we are not immune. It's the classic thing. You are only as safe as as you make yourself, I guess is what I want to say. It's always a good idea to remain diligent and use your best practices to ensure that your devices are safe and secure. So you want to be careful about the apps that you download and install. You also want to be careful about the sites you choose to visit and the links that you click on, kinds of links that you click on. You want to make sure that you're always using secure passwords. I personally like using a thing like 1Password so I can make really strongly encrypted passwords and use different passwords for every service and every site that I go on and access. And make sure that you're using a passcode lock on your device. It's going to be great if Apple gets the fingerprint sensor technology in the iPhone 5S and it's really reliable. I think that's going to cause a lot more people to actually passcode lock their devices. I see so many people who don't do that. And when you passcode lock your device, it's not just that, that you set up that barrier. It's also that it enables encryption on your device. So the data that's on your iPhone is actually stored encrypted. And until you unlock it, hackers can't get at that data and information as easily. So do all of those things. Stay safe out there. Or something to that effect, I think, is what Phil Schiller put out on his Twitter account when all these reports started circulating. And I think that's good advice regardless of your device. And as proof that we are not immune just because we use iOS to different kinds of bugs and attacks and serious crashes and potential problems, there are reports this week of a serious bug that affects not only iOS but also Macs, where just getting them to display some specific kinds of text strings can cause your system to crash. The bug affects actually any app that uses Apple's core text framework to display the string, and that is lots of different apps, including WebKit-based browsers like Safari and I think some versions of Chrome from Google. The example that I saw of this happened to be an Arabic set of characters that, when displayed, would actually crash your browser. And I could confirm it using Safari. I actually wrote some simple little JavaScript to display this string. And the minute that I opened that up in a Safari browser, it actually caused Safari to crash. And I also saw Safari crash when loading the same string that had been posted just to the comments of some websites. So it's a pretty big deal because it's pretty easy to deploy this little string that can actually crash your browser. And on the surface, it seems like it should be pretty easy to avoid and wouldn't be that big of a threat. You know, it's kind of annoyance where you load the page and your browser crashes. Big deal, right? You launch the browser again. But at the very best, it's annoying. At the very worst, it's potentially dangerous. If you crash on Safari, think about it. What happens is you try to reopen Safari, and it tries to reopen the last sites that you were viewing. So in essence, it's going to try and reopen the same site that caused the crash. It will crash again, and then every time you open Safari, it crashes. So just by hitting that little text string, you suddenly have a sort of denial of service attack on your Safari browser. Now, it's relatively easy to get around. You can hold down the Option and Shift key when you launch Safari, and that will cause it not to reopen the tabs that were already open. You could also put it into safe browsing mode. There's a couple different methods you could get to bypass it. But the average user, a novice user, might not realize that, and they might just think suddenly that their browser's broken and need to reinstall their operating system or reinstall the browser, something like that. They might go to more extreme measures. So it's very annoying. And again, it's not just the browser that has this issue. It's any application that uses Apple's core text framework. That includes messages. So someone could send you a message with a string in it that would cause your messages application to crash. And once again, when you try to open messages again, it's going to try and open that same message or display the message that it had open when it crashed and continue to cycle through the crashes. Again, relatively easy to get around because you can simply send a text message to yourself, open it from the lock screen, and that will jump you right to that message, bypassing the other one, and then you can get in and simply delete the bad message that you received. But in the meantime, it's still really annoying. And I know that occasionally you can use app crashes to inject or insert other types of attacks or malware. I'm not sure if this specific bug could be used like that, but Apple has reportedly known about the bug for months and hasn't fixed it in iOS 6. The stories I've been reading supposedly say that it has been addressed in macOS 10 Mavericks as well as iOS 7. I don't know if they're going to go back and update the older versions of the operating systems, but it should be easy to avoid at this point, just as long as you don't have maybe some jerky friends who are sending this string to you in a text message or maybe even posting it on your Facebook wall. That was the thing about it to me, is that it's relatively easy to just put this string anywhere. Someone happens to stumble upon it and it suddenly starts crashing their applications and they don't know why. So you know about it now, so maybe you can avoid it. If you own an Apple TV and you haven't turned it on in a while, or you haven't run your software update, you might want to do that. Apple TV owners received some new content last week. Apple added a couple new channels from Vivo, as well as the Disney Channel, Disney XD, the Smithsonian, and the Weather Channel. Vivo is a new free music video channel, so you can get music videos directly on your Apple TV. The Smithsonian Channel actually has full free episodes of various content, most of it based on science, nature, technology, culture, and the arts. The Weather Channel, it's actually pretty cool. It lets you set up weather set up and get weather forecasts for your area, or you can actually plug in any area you'd like. That, along with video for different places, so you can get a video forecast. You can also get various Weather Channel TV shows, full episodes, all for free, and it gives you access to various Weather Channel content. The Disney Channel content is accessible if you have a cable subscription that includes the Disney Channel or Disney XD. Once you've authenticated with your cable TV provider, it gives you access to all of the episodes and content on demand. And then also, Apple recently added the iTunes Festival channel to the Apple TV. This is live concerts that are streamed once per day all through the month of September. I think they're carried out of London in the UK and feature artists like Justin Timberlake, Katy Perry, Lady Gaga, Elton John, and more. So you can check that out. And those are actually live. They'll have the dates and times that those concerts will be airing, and you can watch them live on your Apple TV. I think you can also watch them live through iTunes on your Mac if you'd like. And you can come back later and also play those concerts. I'm not sure how long they leave them on the Apple TV after the festival has ended, if it's just for the month of September. I would think that they would have them on there a little while longer, maybe a couple months, but eventually they do get removed. So if you want to check out those concerts, those are available on your Apple TV now. Just run your software update if you don't see them. Apple's cash hoard seems to continue to be burning a hole in their pocket, at least when it comes to small tech companies. And we talked last episode about the fact that Apple has been buying up various different tech companies to add to their portfolio and also to their employee and technology base. This time, it's a Swedish-based company called Algotrim. Apple did confirm the deal via All Things D, but didn't comment any further. They typically don't comment on these acquisitions, but Apple reportedly used a Delaware-based holding company named Wedgewood Industries, LLC, to allegedly acquire all of Algotrim's shares back in February. TechCrunch says Algotrim builds codecs and design solutions that maximize performance of data, mobile imaging, video, and computer graphics while minimizing memory requirements. Apple will likely use the company's technology to help them optimize data and processing for their mobile devices, especially iPhones and iPads. The technology can do things like speed up data processing and reduce file sizes. The company reportedly actually built an application for the Japanese carrier KDDI back in 2012 that improved their JPEG file processing up to six times, at least according to Apple Insider. That type of data efficiency could be a big deal for Apple, especially when it comes to storing audio and video files and images on devices with limited storage, stuff like iPhones and iPods. You can imagine being able to store like 4 to 5 times the number of images in your camera roll that you can do today without using up any more storage. So you'd have way more storage, be able to store more files, rather, in the same amount of space. That's the kind of technology these guys reportedly can put together. Also, being able to process large video files faster, all while eating up less battery life, something that, of course, Apple would be very interested in, so it's easy to see why they scooped these guys up. We've been hearing about Apple wearable iWatch rumors for a while now, and I think they've been really heating up over the past 6 to 8 months. But everybody's just wondering and chomping at the bit, you know, when is Apple actually going to put this thing out? When are they going to start shipping something? When are they actually going to make a move? The space is kind of heating up. There's a lot of people entering it. Well, there was a rumor, at least one source this week is hedging their bets and thinking that Apple is going to come out with a product in 2014, not only just release it, but come out in a really huge way. They say Apple is rumored to be gearing up to make 63.4 million smartwatches, which will ship sometime in 2014 and be priced at around $199 US. That's according to a story over on Apple Insider. The claim is based on an interview with CIMB Securities Limited analysts and was written up by the Commercial Times. It claims that the manufacturing is going to be mostly done by a company called Inventec out of Taiwan. Now, the numbers are what are throwing me off on this rumor, because just based on that unit prediction, I would say it has to be far-fetched at best. As Apple Insider points out, 60 million iWatches shipped would be more than 4 times the number of iPads that Apple shipped in the first 12 months after it was introduced. And I just don't think an Apple smartwatch is going to be that popular. This thing would have to be pretty amazing to get all of us to start wearing watches again, right? I can't see demand being that high. I know this is kind of a hot category and it has a lot of buzz, but it still seems much more specialized to me than, say, something like the iPad or even the iPhone. The analyst does say that the product would have a focus on biometrics, which I buy. I think Apple is going to invest heavily in the health monitoring aspect of it, adding things like a pedometer, the altimeter, so it could track steps and elevation, heart rate, probably some other features along with that. I think they're really investigating that whole space just based on some of the hirings that they've done recently. We've talked about some of those, some of the people they're bringing on staff, the guy from the Nike Fuel Band project. I think that's going to be a big focus. So it's not just going to be a watch. There's going to be other pieces built into it. I think Apple is also probably going to design their own application to interface with this, something that has iCloud syncing and integration. I think iCloud will be a big part of it, being able to sort of report probably some social aspects so that you can follow along with your friends, especially on some of the health monitoring features of it. So it's going to be a big deal. I just don't know that it's going to be that huge of a deal. It reportedly will feature a 1.5-inch to 2-inch touchscreen on the display, Some rumors are saying that it may even have curved glass. Whether or not that will come to fruition, we'll have to wait and see. But that smartwatch space, as I said, is certainly heating up. The Verge pointed out that there are 16 different smartwatch products that are either already being sold or are on Kickstarter or on crowdsourced funding sites and things like that, and gaining a lot of popularity, hitting the market now. Every single one of them, though, that I look at just doesn't seem that compelling. I think I talked about the fact that I recently bought a Pebble smartwatch just so I could try this out, see what all the fuss was about, and try and figure out, is this a space, is this a area that Apple really needs to dive into in a big way? And in the current world of smartwatches, all the things that I'm seeing that they do, the functionality that they provide, Apple has this sort of vetting that they reportedly claim that they do, saying, we look at this stuff and go, does this product deserve to exist? Is there a reason for it being? And my conclusion after playing around with the Pebble and looking at some of this other technology is that while the technology itself is super cool, it's a lot of interesting stuff with the paper displays and the touch screens and some of the interactions and things that people are thinking about. But nothing I have seen has said this is a game-changing device. This is going to change the way I interact with technology or the way I do things. And the Pebble, for all the cool things that it has in it, I like it a lot, but it didn't, at the end of the day, really change my life. And if Apple is going to enter the space, I think they really want to have a product that is groundbreaking, that's revolutionary, that blows the space up, and that's what they'll deliver. Is that going to happen in 2014? Maybe, but it's certainly not going to be anything like the stuff that we're seeing now. So prepare for an iWatch, maybe in 2014, maybe later, maybe never. Remember back in 2010 when Steve Jobs announced FaceTime and he said it would be based on open standards so that we could possibly be able to video chat with our friends and family who use other platforms? I was actually super excited when I heard him say that, but a little bit puzzled because Apple typically doesn't do stuff based on open standards. I guess they do occasionally, but very often they're known for their closed proprietary systems. So I was wondering, and I wondered this a lot, you know, whatever happened to that? Why didn't this ever become a thing? Well, iMore ran a story this week that shed a little more light on exactly what happened and why recently the quality of your FaceTime calls might be going down. So if you use FaceTime, I'm not a heavy FaceTime user, but maybe you've noticed that the video quality isn't quite what it used to be. Well, it turns out that there was a patent holding company, often referred to as a patent troll by a lot of people, a company called Vernetx, and they sued Apple over some of the technology that was used in FaceTime. The case basically stopped Apple from being able to move forward with the whole open standard stuff. They were mired in this lawsuit, and it recently came to a head. I think they initially lost the lawsuit, and then they also lost on appeal. So in essence, Vernetx won. I don't know if you say Vernetx or Vernetx. Probably Vernetx is how it's spelled out with the camel casing. But they reportedly won, and Apple has decided to, rather than, I guess, license the technology, try and work around the patent by changing how a core bit of FaceTime actually works. I guess the patent that they were actually in violation of used a technology that allowed them to sort of set up the FaceTime call, basically do the handshake, and then do a peer-to-peer connection or a direct connection between the two FaceTime callers. And in some cases, they had to use routing or relay servers. That was only about 5 to 10% of the calls, FaceTime calls, that were actually being done that way, according to some testimony that was given at the case by an Apple employee. This allowed the calls to be a lot more efficient, to actually be better quality, but that's exactly the technology that Vernetx said was covered by their patents. So that means that Apple now has to change the way all FaceTime calls are working to use these relay servers, and that reportedly started happening in April, and that also is reportedly when Apple started getting a lot more complaints about the quality of FaceTime calls. So again, I haven't noticed this myself, but maybe you did, and this might shed some light on what is going on. But the patent win for Vernetix also means that Apple won't be able to ever set up FaceTime really as an open standard, since anyone that would use that standard would potentially be targeted by a lawsuit by the same company. I guess, you know, that Apple could just simply license the technology and maybe license it in a way that it extends to other people who might use the technology under the open standard. But that doesn't seem to be what they're doing, at least according to the reports that I've been reading. And then I'm thinking as I'm reading this also, Apple has all this cash on hand. You would think that they could just go in there and buy the patent outright. I don't know why they wouldn't do that. I don't know if it's the pride of Apple or maybe just the greed of Vernetix, where they're not willing to sell the entire patent to Apple. But if they could just swoop in there, buy the patent outright, then I think they could be able to move forward with their with what they wanted to do, and they wouldn't have to use these relay servers, and they wouldn't have to suffer the quality of FaceTime calls. But this seems to me like a pretty big blow to everything that Apple was trying to do with FaceTime. So I was a little bit sad to read this report this week. If you rely on or use Java with your Mac under Mac OS X, there is an update that you should be aware of and know about. Apple announced on its support website that there's some new updates available for Java on the Mac. They address a recently identified Java web plugin vulnerability. Since Apple no longer includes or updates Java via their operating system, customers who are running Java do need to be told about and need to follow the instructions on Apple's support website to get the update. I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com. But basically, if you already have Java installed on your system, you can go into your system preferences. Just go into the Apple menu, select system preferences to launch that, and then go into view Java in the Java control panel application that should have been installed, and click on the update tab. That'll allow you to update your Java. Just follow the on-screen instructions and you should be good to go. If you don't see that control panel, you may just need to download and install a new version of Java directly from Oracle's website. There's actually a link in Apple's support article to go get the software. If you don't need Java at all, Apple is recommending that you make sure it's turned off, that you turn off the Java plugin. And if you do use Java only on occasion, that you only turn it on as needed, because there are potential security risks and vulnerabilities with running Java on your system. One of the reasons why Apple doesn't include it built into the operating system anymore, because they want to make sure if you are running it, you have the latest updated version and you just get that directly from Oracle. So wanted to let you know about that just in case you use Java. And then I want to finish up the news this week with just a couple of fun little stories. It looks like Siri was recently updated to take what I consider to be a couple little pot shots at Google Glass. You may or may not be aware, if you have Google Glass, the way that you interface with it or access its system is you say, OK, Glass, to kind of initiate the fact that you're going to be issuing a command to the glasses. And apparently now if you say OK Glass to Siri, it currently generates one of four different responses poking fun at Google's headset. This is according to Apple Insider. They say if you say OK Glass, you might hear Siri respond, "Stop trying to strap me to your forehead, it won't work." Or you might hear her say, "I think that glass is half empty." Or, "I'm not glass, I'm just fine with that." Or, "Glass, I think you have the wrong assistant." So Apple getting a little bit clever, maybe taking a couple pot shots at the competition. It's pretty well known that Tim Cook was not a huge fan of the Google Glass technology. He said as much at the D conference recently. So I don't know if this was triggered by some of Tim Cook's desires or just something that the Apple engineers wanted to roll in to be a little bit clever and snarky. And then The unofficial Apple weblog has a fun story about the Cooper Hewitt Design Museum in New York, which I guess is one of the Smithsonian Institution's 19 museums. They reportedly added some source code for an iOS application into their collection. It's actually the app called Planetary. I think I talked about it or mentioned it a long time ago. It's been out for a little while, or quite a while, I should say. And it's actually a music visualizer written by Bloom Studios. It kind of takes your music and puts it into these planets, and then you have tracks and things that orbit around the planets, and you can navigate through this music solar system to kind of access your music and play different things. Well, I guess the museum recently added the source code for that application into their collection. Not only that, but they actually open sourced it and placed the code on GitHub, so anybody can go grab it. You can fork it, you can do whatever you want with it. And the museum even said that they were committed to boosting the development and outgrowth of the project, and that any descendants of Planetary would be included and preserved into the collection as well. And also, I found this very interesting. As a requirement, the Cooper Hewitt Museum requires that there's a physical paper record of the source code. So they actually went through the trouble of printing it out on archival paper in a machine-readable OCR font, I would assume, so that they could get it back into a computer program if they ever needed to easily, and if for some reason they lost the digital version of the source code. But being on GitHub, that's probably not likely to happen. But still, kind of a cool thing to see iOS source code actually going into the Smithsonian. And so with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show sponsors, and that is Squarespace. You know, Squarespace is awesome. They make it really easy to set up your website. You can do a website, a blog, an online portfolio, an e-commerce site. They basically give you everything you need. And so if you need a website and you need it today, you don't even need to think about it. Just go right over to squarespace.com and sign up. I've actually used Squarespace for some of my websites. I've also referred some of my clients to them because sometimes you just don't have the time. You don't want to take the effort to design and build and custom code an entire website. Maybe you don't have the budget or the resources that you need, or maybe you just want something that looks really good and you don't want to have to get caught up in figuring out all the minor details. There's tons of reasons why you might choose Squarespace. One of the ones that is a big deal to me is they handle everything. You need design? Don't have to worry about it. They have these awesome templates. They're mobile optimized, so you don't have to worry about screen sizes. It's going to look great on Android, on iOS, on tablets, on desktop. It doesn't really matter. All their templates are fully optimized for that. They offer full customization with all the tools that you need for different kinds of features. If you need social, that's built in. You just drop that in and configure it. You need e-commerce, they have that. You need contact forms, they have you covered. You name it, they're going to have a solution for you. And they handle hosting and domain registration. Plus, you get 24/7 tech support that's done by actual real human beings in New York. You can contact them. You can get help with your site. So you don't have to get bogged down and all that stuff. You just put your site together. You get it up there. It looks great. And if and when you get to the point where you do want to get mired down in the technology, you want to get down to the nitty-gritty, they have tools to allow you to do that too. You can fully customize the HTML, the CSS, the JavaScript. You can do as little or as much as you want. And did I mention it's really affordable? They actually have plans starting as low as $8 a month. If you sign up for a year, you get your domain registration for free. And best of all, right now, they're doubling the discount offer that they're offering MacCast listeners. So for the next month, you can get 20% off, 20% off your Squarespace account. Just go to squarespace.com. Make sure you use the offer code MacCast9 when you sign up, and you're going to get 20% off. I really recommend you sign up for a year at this discount because you're going to get 20% off that full year of everything you need to create an awesome website. You can still get the free trial if you like. Try it out for free, but I would just go ahead and sign up, get the 20% off, and you're good to go. If you need to put a website together, you really need to check out Squarespace. Squarespace.com, offer code MacCast9, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So on the last episode, I had a voicemail from a listener who was in the market for a new car, and he wanted to know, what car can I go out and buy that's going to give me the best possible integration with my iOS devices? I have the ability to get this new car. I'm going to buy a brand new 2013 model. What do you guys think is the best model, the thing that I should go for? And I got a lot of follow-up on this. A lot of you responded and had opinions. Derek says that he has a new 2013 Chevy Volt. It has a MyLink system. And he said it integrates very nicely with his iPhone. It just syncs up with the Bluetooth. Everything kind of integrates. It works. It also has a USB port built in, so you can use that for charging, or you can actually use that for syncing up music. It's the kind of thing where you can plug in a USB stick with uncopy protected audio files, and it'll just recognize those and allow you to control and play those. I guess that also works with iPods and iPhones and things like that, if you have that kind of content. And the steering wheel controls allow you to control things like the audio playback, access Siri. You can take calls in the car through the built-in microphone, and he said it works flawlessly. And so I received that as an email comment. I also received a number of audio comments like these two from Todd and Paul.
Hey, Adam, how are you? This is Todd in Covington, Connecticut. Responding to the gentleman who's out buying a new car, I just bought a 2013 Nissan Altima back in November, and Bluetooth is the way to go. I mean, as long as it's got Bluetooth, you're good to go. You know, I get out of my car, turn it off, and whatever I was listening to on Bluetooth stops automatically. I get back in, I turn the car on, and whatever I was listening to comes right back on. On your show or any other podcast, I get the information, I get the countdown on the time on my screen. It's easy. If I do need to use Siri, I just push and hold the home button, and then I can use my microphone that's built in and just talk through there. So really just pushing the button once, and then when I want to end Siri, I just hit the hang up button that's on my steering wheel. So I don't think you need any special to buy a special automobile at this point. You know, I know there's some stuff coming from with Apple integration soon, but I'm pretty happy with what I'm doing right now. The other thing I'm using is something called the Kinu Airframe. It's a little iPhone holder that sticks into your radiator flaps. That thing works good and very simple. I actually bought it at the Apple Store, $25. So it's sitting right there. I can see it's great when you're charging and you want navigation. But as long as it's got Bluetooth, like my Nissan, I'm pretty happy. I can do everything with Siri and certainly everything streaming, music, podcasts, all that. Thanks, Adam. Have a great day.
Hi, Adam. Paul King here. Long-time listener. Just want to touch base with you on the car phone sync question. I've got a VW that has excellent Mac, or I should say iPod connectivity. I haven't tried it with a phone yet, but that seems to work quite well. And I took a business trip with a fellow this last week in his BMW, and even though I've got an older iPod, it hooked up right away and it recognized it, and he had a new phone to sync and it took it like automatically. So I think that anything from the VW family of manufacturers, which obviously include Audi and Porsche or BMW, or you know, any of the medium to upper end manufacturers should probably have that kind of capability by this time. It seems like it's become a standard thing, unless you're talking about strictly economy cars. In any case, enjoy the show, and keep listening.
So big thanks to Derek and Todd and Paul for their feedback. It sounds like to me the summary of everything that I'm hearing is pretty much if your car has Bluetooth audio support, if that's built into the new vehicle, and possibly has a built-in mic and system for interfacing with a phone, you're probably good to go for the most part for actually most functionality. You don't need the highly specialized iOS in the car that is coming out in, you know, the near future here. If you want to take even fuller advantage, I guess, of the integration, that's going to help. But right now, it sounds like most of the functionality that people need on a daily basis is just accessible and usable through Bluetooth integration built into the car. If you want something that fully integrates with the built-in navigation system, GPS and stuff that's in your vehicle, you might want to do a little bit more research before you buy. But it sounds like a lot of car manufacturers are also already pretty well supporting iOS devices, at least from everything I'm hearing from you. So if I've gotten that wrong or if I missed something, let me know. But I think, you know, as you're shopping around, just look for Bluetooth support, and that's probably all you're going to need. The other thing I got a lot of feedback for this week was my comments on my feelings about Apple's podcast application. I've become a little bit frustrated recently. I went on a Twitter rant regarding Apple's podcast application, which I really have to clarify. You know, I give it a hard time, and a lot of us give it a hard time, but it's only because I don't think it's the best podcast app out there. And I really feel that Apple should be striving to have the best podcast app. I think they probably actually are, but they're falling very, very short in my opinion. So I had made some comments to that effect and asked for some responses. And a lot of you agree with me, but I also got a lot of responses like this one from Andy, who rose up to defend Apple's app a little bit.
Hey there, Adam. Thought I'd send you this message regarding the podcast debate that you instigated on Twitter. In my opinion, I really like the Apple podcast application because it's just, I think it works really well, especially with iCloud, and it syncs whatever you're playing on your device, your iPad, iPhone, whatever. In my case, it's on my iPhone. And then when I get to my iMac at home, I can play it from where I left off, which I think is a really cool feature. I like the chapter feature as well, which, to be fair, most of the podcasts that I have on my device don't have them apart from yours. But I really like how it works, and I wish all my other podcasts that I subscribe to use this feature as well. Because it's real good. Obviously, you can just skip to whenever you want, and if you'd have to, like, you know, listen through the stuff that you've listened to before. But I completely understand the points that you're making. But I think from the user point of view, which is myself, I don't really think the issues that you're saying affects me. I mean, this is just me, my opinion talking here. I don't know about anybody else, but I don't really think of it as an issue. The album art and the chapters, I don't really find that an issue. It's a bit of an issue when you look down the chapter where it just says chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, whatever, rather than saying, you know, introduction and then the various topics as you go through in the podcast. That is a bit of an issue. But apart from that, I don't really find any problem with it. I do like the layout and everything. I like how, you know, the album art, the main album art, is displayed and how it all figures out, and how you can subscribe to it on the device, because I remember how poor it was, and, you know, it didn't have that feature. But now I like how I don't have to, like, sync to my iMac all the time. I can just, you know, download the podcast as it become available straight from my device, which I really like. I've not really looked at any of the podcasts because, like I said, I downloaded the Apple one when it first came out, and then I didn't really need to look at any of those because I was playing it for the music app. And then when they finally fixed it, it was like, you know, this is great. You know, I've not really got the need to look for any more. But I completely understand what you're saying, and I hope this debate, or should we say this discussion, goes on, because I think it's a good thing to talk about. Anyways, keep up with the good work. Love the podcast. Listen to it as soon as you put it onto up for download, and I really enjoy listening to it. Right, keep up with the good work. This is Andy from Yorkshire in the UK. Thanks very much.
Hey, thanks, Andy. I really appreciate your opinion, and I totally get it that a lot of people are really happy with Apple's app. But again, I guess part of my frustration is that they haven't done a good job supporting their own format. You mentioned in there one of my big pet peeves is this bug with the chapter titles, and I don't know why they won't fix it, and that's a point of frustration for me. So I think it's great that everybody gets to use what they want. My concern is also a little bit about what you mentioned there, that because it's the default app, it's the Apple app, it's something that people will settle for, and I just think there's other better third-party applications out there. I got an email comment from Tony, and I wanted to read his because he, in essence, also kind of defends Apple a little bit. He says, I would like to chime in with a comment regarding the discussion of Apple's podcast app. It is important to remember that, quote, back in the day, Apple was not shy to point out that their reason for developing software was to provide some feature that third parties were not providing or to, quote unquote, set the bar for third parties to strive to be above. This was especially true with Mac, right? This was a common explanation for encouraging developers without killing the market like their nemesis at the time Microsoft would often do. Granted, things have changed, as with the Pro line, where Apple saw a need to protect its Mac Pro sales and control of those artistic markets, and in the recent case of iWork versus Office in the new world. I believe Apple consistently walks the line with each product, looking at the market and deciding whether the marketplace is living up to its device potential and acts accordingly. A company such as Apple that pays such close attention to every detail of every aspect of its business deserves the benefit of the doubt when it comes to making these decisions. And again, I think the problem I'm having here is that in this case, Apple hasn't been paying that close attention to every detail. I get the point that they're not solving every problem and that they're leaving some space for third parties to come in and develop better apps. And I think third parties have done that. But I think from a base level, Apple hasn't shown that this is how we think this kind of app should be built. And that's my main complaint there. And again, still others of you have trouble like I have with Apple's app, and that includes people like David.
Hi, Adam. It's David in Connecticut, and I'm responding regarding your comments about the Apple Podcast app in iOS. I, too, like yourself, have been recording enhanced podcasts using GarageBand for a number of years. And, you know, they work fine in many, many scenarios. Certainly Downcast plays them without a problem at all in iOS. They work just fine. You get mixed results using the podcast app from one version of that to another. Sometimes, it's okay. Sometimes, maybe not. But there's a new problem that just emerged that I just discovered, and that is the actual iTunes 11 app on the computer in macOS. Because with iTunes 11, and I'm referring specifically to 11.0.5, with enhanced podcasts, all I'm getting is the main logo for my podcasts. It's not going from chapter to chapter. Now, I do get the chapter stops, and the chapter stops show all of the little icons with all of the special differences between them in terms of the screens and the labels, etc., etc. It looks great. But in terms of what you're seeing when you look at the actual enlarged movie icon on screen is you just get the logo, and so you're not going from screen to screen. Apple, what's going on?
Hey, David. First of all, good luck getting out of the well. And second of all, sorry I had to. I am totally with you. And I think I actually commented on this on my last show that Apple is not supporting their own technologies when it comes to their podcast app. They developed the AAC format, this enhanced format where we can have these chapter markers and changing album art and all those sorts of things. And definitely in iTunes 11, they are not supporting that functionality. You don't get the changing album art. You don't get the hyperlinks anymore along with the album art. Like you said, they do have the chapter markers in their chapter dropdown, but I'm just waiting for them to drop support for that too. So I really am just at a loss as to why Apple is doing what they're doing. And I really think my point still stands that they really need to continue to support the formats that they pioneered and push, but they tend to start these things and sort of drop them. And I'll give you some other examples. QuickTime had some amazing interactive features and functionality that Apple was rolling into it. So you could do these great interactive kind of movies and stuff like that. never went anywhere. Apple never really did anything with it. I also think they're starting to abandon the amazing iBook format that they built with iBooks Author. iBooks Author is this amazing tool. They threw it out there, and they haven't really done much with it since. You can create these interactive books, but a lot of people aren't really creating them because Apple doesn't support it. Let's talk about the iTunes album. Remember that? That was going to be the thing that was going to replace CDs and liner notes and stuff like that. You could get all this cool extra content with your iTunes music. You encourage people to buy full albums instead of single tracks. That never really went anywhere. I don't know that that's necessarily Apple's fault, but still, it was an interesting technology, and it's sort of been left to languish. For me, the enhanced AAC podcast is an amazing format. Everybody that listens to my show says they love it. They absolutely love it. I get positive feedback over and over again. So why is Apple not continuing to support this? They have great tools built into GarageBand for it. It was a great format up until iTunes 11 and this podcast app. And I really hope it doesn't go away. I don't want to see it go away, but it ends up getting frustrating for me. Why am I doing all this extra work? I'm doing it for you in a lot of ways, but if Apple continues to make it harder and harder, I just have this feeling that fewer and fewer of us are even going to bother. And especially if they don't even display the features that are there, it's going to get very hard to continue to want to support it. So I don't want to see that happen. I just want to see Apple move forward. My guess is that at some point, at least on the desktop, they're going to pull the podcasts out of iTunes and put the podcast app as a standalone app in macOS 10. And maybe that means if they do that, we're going to get some of these features back on the desktop outside of iTunes. So the podcast app does support chapters and some of these other things. So I'm welcoming maybe that happening because I don't see those features coming back into iTunes. So I don't know. There's some hope, but I still just don't feel that Apple's making the best podcast app that they possibly can. And I'd really like to see them doing that. And that's what this comes down to. Another conversation that we've often had on the MacCast has to do with Apple's App Store and some of the challenges that it's posed for developers. That's both the Mac App Store and the iOS App Store. And one of those common themes that comes up over and over again is the whole idea of paid-for upgrades. A lot of developers have moved to sort of a new model where they'll put out a new version specifically of an iOS app and make that a whole new paid version. So if you have version one, you bought that, you get the version one updates, and then when they need to do the next major release, version two, for example, they'll put out a whole new version of the app, and you basically just rebuy the application. So that's one way of handling that. Well, this week, the Omni Group came out with a pretty creative way of handling this upgrade pricing, specifically on the Mac desktop. They came out with a way to allow their customers to get upgrade pricing on Omni Group applications, even if they originally purchased the app via the Mac App Store. And what they developed was this free application that you download called Omni Keymaster. You download the app and run it, and what it will do is scan your Mac for any Omni Group applications that you purchased via the Mac App Store, and then it goes out to the Omni servers and generates you a new license key for free. So now you have a full license key that you can download the app from Omni, use that key to register it, and then you can also then take that key and use it for getting paid upgrades at a discounted price directly from the Omni Group. They also point out that you can get your app updates a little bit faster because very often with the App Store, they have to push out an update, especially a critical update, maybe a security update, and then wait for it to get App Store approval, and then it gets pushed out on the App Store. So it might be several days, a week or two before you actually get that update. If you go directly through or have the ability to go directly through their website, you can get that update much more quickly. So there's a lot of reasons for them to move in this direction and do this. And I thought it was a pretty creative way of handling it. And I just wanted to recognize that and mention it. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see some other app developers going a similar route and developing a similar kind of system based on the Omni model. John in the UK sent me an email this week, and it serves as a good story, kind of a good reminder about backups, about AppleCare support, about extended warranties or warranty extension programs and things like that that Apple might offer. So I wanted to share his story with you. What happened was he emailed me to let me know that he had an iMac and recently his hard drive failed. And luckily, he did some checking and remembered that Apple had a warranty extension program for specific model iMacs. And it turned out that his iMac and his specific hard drive was covered under the Apple iMac 1TB Seagate hard drive replacement program. This affects, I think, 2012 certain models of 2012 iMacs that had the 1TB Seagate hard drives in them. And I'll have a link to the program in the show notes at maccast.com. But basically, if you go to Apple's support website at apple.com/support, there's a little tab that has their extension, warranty extension programs. I think it's down in the bottom left. And you can click on that. They'll have the most recent ones usually listed. And then you can click through to get a list of all of the current programs that they're running. And it's a good reminder to not be afraid to go in and check that, and to not be afraid to call up AppleCare support or even make an appointment at your local Genius Bar, even if you think your machine isn't under warranty anymore, because it might have a part or component that Apple's chosen to extend the warranty on. Maybe they discovered, hey, we just got a batch of defective parts, certain units are impacted, and we're going to go ahead and extend the warranty beyond the standard coverage. So that could happen, and that happened in John's case. So he was able to go in and have them swap out and replace the hard drive under that program. And one of the first things they ask you when you're getting your Mac serviced at the Apple Store and they know they're going to replace your drive is, hey, do you have a backup? And of course, being a MacCast listener, John had not only one backup, he was able to tell the guy, yep, I have got two backups, don't worry. And he had a Time Machine backup that went to a time capsule, and his second backup was a Time Machine backup going to a Synology disk station network-attached storage device. So he was good to go. The one thing he pointed out is keep in mind that Apple won't give you back the hard drive that they're replacing. So if you have data on that drive and you're concerned about it getting out there into the world, if you can, go ahead and wipe the drive before you bring it in. You know, make sure you've got your backups, verify your backups, but then wipe the drive before you bring it into Apple. Now, in Tom's case, the hard drive had failed, so he couldn't. So you just got to rely on the fact that Apple promises to wipe the data or destroy the drive before they do anything with it. And I think in this case, what they'll do is send them back to Seagate. Seagate will wipe and refurbish the drives and then dole them out as refurbished drives, things like that. So you kind of got to go on the trust system on that one. But John went ahead, had his Mac serviced, and he got the Mac back. It had a clean install of Mac OS X Lion on it. He was currently running Mountain Lion. That was what was in his backups. And so he went to run Migration Assistant or the Setup Assistant to restore his data, and he ran into a little bit of an issue, unfortunately. And it turned out to be a somewhat isolated but pretty serious bug that's being reported on. There was a whole Apple discussion thread he pointed me to. I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com. But what it seems like is that in a small number of cases with Time Machine, for some reason, Time Machine starts excluding the top-level system, library, and maybe some hidden private folders from your backup. And you may or may not realize this is happening, and they don't show up in the hey, don't back these things up list in the system preferences. It just suddenly starts not backing up the top level system library and hidden folders. And I guess in some cases it causes the Time Machine drive to not even be recognized or show up as a source in the startup or Migration Assistant options. And I think that's what happened in John's case. Luckily, he was still able to go back through and manually restore a lot of the stuff from his user folder, but it was a much longer process for doing the restore, and he did lose some system-level application preferences and application support data because that wasn't being backed up. And so the lesson learned there was something that we've talked about in the past is we also not only need to set up our backups, but we need to go back through and occasionally verify the backups are happening. I got caught by this. I had to admit one time that I had manually turned off my Time Machine backups, and I forgot that I did that. And had I been going in and checking periodically to make sure things were being backed up, I probably would have noticed that sooner, and not when I went to go back and restore, then realized my data that I wanted wasn't there. That was a pretty awful day for me. So you want to make sure you go through and check your backups, verify your backups, make sure you can restore data, make sure the data that you think is being backed up is still there. You also want to make sure that you have not only multiple backups, but you probably don't want to rely on one specific technology. So in this case, both of the backups were using Time Machine, and Time Machine happened to have this bug in it. So both backups were affected. You probably want to do Time Machine and then maybe use a different technology, something like SuperDuper or Carbon Copy Cloner, or maybe a ChronoSync backup, or a combination of all of those. Also, have offsite backup as another option. So do that, and then again, don't be afraid to go on Apple support, search through discussion threads if you run into an issue, find out more information, find out if there is a support program for maybe the issue that you're having with your Mac, and maybe it's covered, even again if you're outside of AppleCare. So some good lessons in this little story from John, and John, thank you for sharing it with us. I don't know if you're like me, but ever since Apple had movie content on iTunes, I have purchased some of that content from the iTunes store. And more lately, I'm starting to purchase more iTunes movies because, one, Apple's moved to high definition, and also, two, they give me the ability to re-download my content. Now, we've talked about the fact that even though you can re-download content, you want to make sure that you back it up and archive the stuff that you purchase, because Apple doesn't guarantee that they're always going to carry those titles. If a studio gets a wild hair and decides to pull their content from iTunes, you might not have the ability to re-download it. So make sure that you're backing it up. But iLounge ran a great piece this week on how to maybe upgrade some of your older purchased iTunes content to the new higher HD format. Because if you remember, and if you've been doing this long enough, Apple, when they originally released HD, they were just doing 720p HD, and now they distribute and have 1080p HD. So chances are, if you downloaded and made your purchase in the past and haven't changed it or re-downloaded it, you have the lower resolution 720p version. So what if you want to get the higher res version? And Apple doesn't distinguish between whether you bought the 720p or the 1080p. They just allow you to download the HD content in whatever format you want. So there is a chance, depending on what your iTunes preferences were set at, that even if you bought after they offered the 1080p version, that you might only have the 720p. And that's because if you go into iTunes preferences and you look in the store preferences, there is an option to set downloading to default to 720p or 1080p. So the first thing you're going to want to do is make sure that you've opted to download 1080p high definition content. So go into iTunes preferences, go into the store tab, and make sure the when downloading high definition videos prefer option is set to 1080p. So set it to that and click OK. So that's the first step. The second step is to re-download your 720p content as 1080. So in this case, you're going to go to the iTunes store, you're going to click on the purchases link in the sidebar, you're going to go into the movies tab, and you're going to re-download or click the download button on any movies that have the little cloud icon and re-download those as 1080p. To find the content that's not already on your computer, you can use the not in this computer tab to make that stuff easier to find, and just simply re-download it. Now, you're not going to have the re-download options if the 720p content is already on your computer. So actually, before you go in and do that, you might have to remove that content. Now, I'm giving you this step after the step that I just told you, because you'll want to check again and make sure that the content you want to re-download is already in the iTunes store and available for you to re-download before you delete it locally from your Mac. So once you've verified, yes, it's in the store, I can re-download it, you can go back to your Mac, find the 720p version, delete it, you have it backed up and archived, right? And then once you've done that, you can go back into the iTunes store and re-download it. And when you re-download it again, because you've changed the setting in iTunes to default to 1080p content, it should pull down the 1080p version of that movie. And here is another little tip. When you delete the old 720p version, just press delete. That'll give you the option to move the file to the trash, or it by default moves the file to the trash. Leave it in the trash until you've downloaded the new version of the movie and confirmed that it can play back and that you've got the higher quality version. Once you've done that, then you can go ahead and empty the movie out of the trash, and then you can repeat this for each movie in your library and slowly upgrade all of them from 720p to 1080p. And as I was working on this tip, I thought, you know, one of the challenges is going to be trying to figure out how you know which HD movies in your current library are 720p versus 1080p. And you could go through, select each one, choose get info, and look at the resolution and stuff like that. But if you have a lot of movie content, that is going to take quite a bit of time. So I realized you could use a simple spotlight search and search tokens to actually narrow down and find the movies and videos that are in 720p. So if you go into the Finder and you hit Apple F, or you know, open up the Find screen, you can type in the token kind, K-I-N-D, and then type Apple MPEG-4 movie as the kind, and that will narrow your search to all of Apple's MPEG-4 movie type. And then you can also type in the resolution token, which is width, colon, and then the width for a 720p movie from iTunes is 1280 pixels. So width 1280, and that will show you all of your 720p movies that you have currently on your Mac. Now, it might pick up some other movies that you have loaded, but mostly it's going to find, since you said the kind is Apple MPEG 4 movie, it's going to find the iTunes content. So that worked for me to kind of help narrow down and find the movies that I was looking for. And then the other thing I discovered as I was working with this tip also works great if you have older movies, even if they are standard definition content. I remember that when Apple first announced they were selling movies on iTunes, one of the big blockbuster movies that was out was Pirates of the Caribbean. So to test out the system, I downloaded or purchased Pirates of the Caribbean, and I had not upgraded or done anything with that since my original download. So when I went in to look at it, it was in a 640 by 272 resolution, so not very high res. I went ahead and tried this trick with that movie. I removed that version and I re-downloaded it from iTunes, and I got a 853 by 362 version, so a much higher quality version. So my guess is that periodically, as technology changes, Apple goes through and re-encodes some of these movies and content. So you might be able to get actually a better digital version of it, of something that you purchased a long time ago. So you might even want to go through your collection and just re-download movies that you downloaded a long time ago. The only thing you'll need to bear in mind is that as you're re-downloading higher quality versions, it's going to eat up more storage space on your Mac. So make sure you have enough headroom and enough available storage space. A typical 2-hour 1080p HD movie, at least on my system, looks like it's taking up between 5 to 6 gigabytes of storage. So just account for that and good luck. But I thought this was a great tip for getting higher quality movies of content that maybe you purchased a long time ago. And then finally, for this week's episode, I am going to cover a tip that I know I've covered many times over the years, but it always comes up. So I think it's definitely worth a refresh. And it's, if you go to compose an email using Apple's mail application and you're entering an address, an email address, into the to field or any of the sending fields, it will start to try and autocomplete that address. And maybe as you're typing, you notice, oh, hey, that's the wrong email address for the person that I'm trying to get to. But that's really odd because I know that I updated it in the contacts application. And sure enough, you go look in contacts, you look at that email address, and it's correct in contacts, yet it's still showing up wrong in mail. And another scenario that people get into is they're entering that address into mail and it's auto-completing, and suddenly it's showing these addresses for people that you know you don't even have in your contacts database. So again, you go look at the contacts app and, like, sure enough, they're not in there. That person's not in there. So why is mail auto-completing, or why the wrong address, or an address that's not even in my contacts database? And the answer may seem obvious when I tell it to you, but it's not obvious when you're actually composing that email. And it's that mail doesn't use your contacts for that recipients list. What it actually uses is its own previous recipients list, and it contains the names of anyone that you've ever sent an email to. So that's why you're seeing names that aren't in your contacts database, and that's why you might be seeing names with the wrong email address, even though you've updated them in contacts. So the way you can manage the previous recipients list and get that cleaned up is you go into the mail application, go over to the Windows menu or window menu, and choose previous recipients to view and manage the previous recipients list. And so you'll see this big long list. You can go through, you can select any name on that list. You can click the button to remove them from the list. Down at the bottom, you'll notice there's also an option to add them to contacts if you'd like. So you can use this list to add people to your contacts database. And there's also, if you have a lot of names in this list, there's a search field at the top. So you can narrow down the name or the email address that you're looking for. And so that's how you manage that list. And again, this comes up almost every year, maybe even a couple times a year, where someone's like, why is that? I don't understand this. And it's one of those curious things. I'm not sure why Apple keeps this separate from your contacts list, but that's the way it is, and that's how you manage it. So that's everything that I have for you for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment, and I want to thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, and Disk Label, also Text Expander Touch for your iPhone or iPad, and PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad. You can check out all their software, get more information and details over at smilesoftware.com. The Transporter by Connected Data. You can get all the benefits of cloud storage with the control and security and privacy of a physical hard drive or NAS. Also, you can get 10% off your own personal transporter by using the offer code MACCAST. Just head over to filetransporter.com/MACCAST and you can take advantage of that. Gazelle, it's the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your iPhone, your iPad, or other Apple products are worth over at gazelle.com and take advantage of their lock-in pricing until October 15th on your iPhones. With the new iPhones coming out, you're going to want to grab your Gazelle price right now. You can do that over at gazelle.com. Get your offer today and check it all out. And Squarespace, it's the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, online portfolio, or blog. You can get a free trial as well as 20% off this month by going to squarespace.com and using the offer code MACCAST9. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MACCAST. Big thank you to you for your support. Please keep your emails, your audio comments coming. I love hearing from you. You can send those to MACCAST@gmail.com. You can also call in on the voicemail line. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MACCAST, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me on Twitter, that's twitter.com/maccast. And be sure to check out the Facebook page at facebook.com/TheMACCAST. And you can find us on Google Plus as well. There's a Google Plus community. Just search for MACCAST on Google Plus and it will come right up. Look forward to seeing you online. But until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.